Hello, everyone. Welcome to a very special episode of Uncanny Treks as we cover episode 4 of The Penguin, episode 4 of Too Old to Die Young, episode 4 of The Penguin, I think it's called Centan, I don't really speak Italian, episode 4 of Too Old to Die Young is The Tower. Matt, how are you doing tonight?
This episode of The Penguin was great, but we don't see a lot of The Penguin. We've seen the least of The Penguin this episode, and we don't see Vic at all. It's the flashback episode you promised, Bub.
We'll take a victory lap on, I said there would be a flashback episode, and I was right. I do think probably there might still be another flashback episode. In episode 5, we got to see the point of it, events of this flashback from the Penguin's point of view.
I would think you're right, Bob. I think you may just be right, because we do need to see what happens. And they went through the trouble of making him up for that one scene to look like he was younger. So, you know, they didn't waste all that money and time and makeup to just to do that.
To do the one scene. And I think you would want to get more out of Mark Strong than just this one episode too, which we'll get to. Yeah, Matt. So were you surprised? I was surprised, but were you surprised when this episode starts by revealing that Penguin and Sophia split up right before the cliffhanger, which somewhat changes the meaning of the cliffhanger from last
episode? It completely changes the circumstances for Penguin abandoning Sophia at the end of the last episode. I just thought he was being a coward, but really he knows he's pretty much screwed. Sophia's aware.
Did you catch all the Batman the Animated Series references this episode? Summer Gleason and Congressman Hill being the two I'm thinking of.
Oh yeah, we got a nice little nod there with Summer Gleason. That's the one character that we haven't seen too many live action versions of from the animated series. They always try to pump in these characters into these live action
shows.
She's
no Vicki Vale, Matt.
Oh, definitely no Vicki Vale. Speaking of which, what happened to Vicki Vale in the comics, Bob? But Vicki Vale does appear in the Batman video game, Bob, Arkham City.
We were too stupid to know this as kids, and maybe you've given it some thought and you understand it now. But now, just giving it thought for the first time in over 2 decades, probably what happened is that they brought Vicki Vale back briefly in the late 80s because she was going to be in the movie. And then once the movie was done, they were like, oh yeah, we don't need her anymore. She only shows up a few other times since the late 80s, early 90s. The one time I'm thinking of is I'm pretty sure she's somehow involved in Battle for the Cowl, that crossover that happened right after Batman RIP.
That actually makes a whole lot of sense, because since Kim Basinger did not return for Batman Returns in 92...
Well, Matt, speaking of tangents and crackpot theories, I did have another crackpot theory. So one of the hangman's victims is Yolanda Jones. You think there's any chance that's Waylon Jones's mother?
Are we really going to do this? Are we going to go through the show and just every last name that fits some character, we're going to be like, oh, yeah, that's related to so-and-so. That's so-and-so's grandma. That's so-and-so's brother, cousin. I don't know, Bob, but it could be.
I mean, what else do we have to say about this very mid-show? Yeah.
We're just trying to make the references. Maybe, I guess, just the little Easter eggs we think are there. But I mean, come on. Jones is a pretty common last name, Bob.
Yolanda, Waylon, there's a lot of letters in common. Somebody just rearranged it.
You're grasping at straws.
If I was a character in a show, say my name was Bob Jones.
Yeah.
And then somebody showed up and their name was Cobb Jones. He could be forgiven for wondering if there was a relationship between Bob and Cobb Jones.
I'll be honest with you, Bob. Let's say you meet some guy in the real world, and his name is Wayne. Last name is Wayne. Does your brain automatically try to associate him with Bruce?
I don't think I ever actually have met a real-life person with the last name Wayne. Until I've lived that life, Matt. Until I've had that lived experience, as the woke say, I don't know if I could say what I would do.
When you have to shake someone's hand and say, Mr. Wayne, it is the weirdest. Trust me, it's just going to make you feel like you're talking to Batman. A 90-year-old man, Bob, you're just sitting there and your brain is like, Mr. Wayne.
Since you're complaining about me spotting cameos, which I don't know why you're complaining about, since that's literally all I do on these shows.
I'm just saying, Jones, if Killer Croc shows up by the end of the show, Bob, we'll have to, what do you want? I'll do something, Bob. If Killer Croc shows up in the show...
I just want the words said on the podcast. You are right, Bob. God, you are right.
Okay, Bob. When it happens, I will say those words. And I'll tell you what, I'll even do this, Bob. If we see like little baby Waylon Jones show up, or some little boy comes out of the sewer for a minute. And, oh, that's weird. This little guy coming out of the sewer. What's he doing? His mom's calling Waylon. He's popping up.
He'll be trying to crush his dad, Matt. Holiday killed it. Or they're not Holiday. The hangman killed it.
Bob, did you say we're going to have a flashback episode?
Oh, that's true. All right. So episode 5, we're calling another flashback from the Penguin's perspective. And we're saying we just might get a little Waylon Jones cameo in the next episode as well. On to more substantive matters. Were you surprised how much they made Mark Strong look like John Turturro with both playing the Roman, a.k.a. Carmine Falcon?
I thought for a minute, maybe they got him.
Well, and it's remarkable to me because I do not think of John Turturro and Mark Strong as guys who generally look similar. Strong is the tall, bald British man. John Turturro is a short, I think he's both Jewish American and Italian American. Granted, he plays Jewish roles and Italian roles both. I just do not think of them as looking similar. And so, yeah, having them look so similar was pretty shocking to me.
Can I just say this show is proof that the traditional makeup department and prosthetics and everything like that looks so much better than CGI. With Penguin, and then in this case, they had to do a number on him to make him look so similar to John Turturro. Didn't make him look like the character from Batman Begins. You don't miss a beat. This isn't like with Marvel with the Harrison Ford thing.
Thunderbolt Ross, Red Hulk. It's like Harrison Ford probably didn't even go into the studio to record voice work. He probably just basically sold them the right to say that he was playing.
Oh man, that's so depressing. I don't know
why you gotta bring like Harrison Ford is as Thunderbolt Ross is the most depressing thing in contemporary pop culture. I think. Is this, think of something that's more depressing than that.
Bob, is this not just the equivalent of like Marlon Brando though playing Jor-El?
It is, but it's also worse because Brando, look, playing Jor-El was a total waste of Brando's talents. It was totally ridiculous, but Brando could still act in 78.
Oh, yeah, like, for sure.
Harrison Ford, when was the last movie he tried in? Probably the late 90s?
Yeah, I can't really think of anything that I just loved him in. Absolutely. Like, there's not a movie that he just, like, defines other than stuff from the 90s yet.
He shows up in Blade Runner 2 and in the Star Wars sequel trilogy. They don't even take him into costume.
And wheeled him out.
I want to be clear. I respect him for not trying in Star Wars. I'm not saying he should try in the Star Wars sequels. There's nothing to try for in those. But it was a little dispiriting. I thought Blade Runner 2049 was a great movie, and it was a little dispiriting to have it derailed about three-fourths of the way through with Harrison Ford just showing up and doing nothing for 7 minutes.
Can I just say, though, Bob, I respect him for reaching that level of stardom. I'm just going to cash in that money. Yeah, check. There is some respect I have there.
While I wasn't even thinking about, but yeah, Indiana Jones 4 and 5, the Star Wars sequels trilogy, and Captain America 4 just should not exist. And so it's upsetting.
He's cashing checks, but that's okay. I would do the same thing if they would just tell me to come on in and, you know.
Yeah, no,
was anything, you know.
It's more an indictment on the studio system and the fans than it's an indictment on him personally. Matt, to go back to my favorite thing and your least favorite thing, let's play a little other reference spotting for this episode. So the cop that arrests Sophia is Bill Kinsey. He's a crooked narcotics cop in the Gotham Central comic series. So I did not know that. I had to look his name up and found that.
Okay, so you actually legit were able to. Okay, so this is a legit character from the comics, not you just speculating. Yeah. This is that dude from Gotham Central. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm just saying, I don't remember Gotham Central so well that I knew who he was. I just was one. They're saying that name a lot. Should I know who that is? And then a similar thing was Sophia's main doctor at Arkham is Dr. Ventress, who I believe we never get a first name for. That sounded like something that is somebody in the comics. It's a very comic book villain name, Ventress. And it may be a reference to the 1950s Batman villain, the Mirror Man.
Yes.
But to be clear, that is not the same character. I also thought this, but it's not the same character as the Flash villain, the Mirror Master.
Does he wear lots of mirrors on his costume, the Mirror Man?
I would have to look again, but I think no, because it was the 50s, and so they weren't like really committing as hard to superhero costumes.
So he was more grounded is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
For the 1950s.
So Floyd Ventress, I think, is the name from the comic. So I don't think they say Floyd in the show. And I'm looking at what I think is an image from Mirror Man's first appearance, and he's just a bald dude who seems to probably be pretty with a really funny shaped head. And he's got orange glasses and a blue lab coat and then a red Colonel Sanders tie.
He seems very generic, like the dude who used to play piano for Late Night Guy.
Paul, what's his face? Paul, for Letterman?
Yes, Letterman. He used to, yeah, he looks like the piano, the guy who played keyboards for Letterman.
Do you remember the episode of Batman, the animated series from the early 90s, where it was basically a dude was basically the Invisible Man and was stalking his daughter?
Yeah, that was an off episode, yes, but I do remember that.
Yeah, so that the DC Wiki has him as a version of the Mirror Man, and his name is Lloyd Ventrix in the animated series, not to be confused with Floyd Ventress, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know what else he went by, Bob? Mojo.
So he was pretending to be his daughter's invisible friend. Maybe that's what she called the invisible friend.
That would make a lot of sense. I do remember that character, but the episode is one of those, it's just kind of one-shot type thing that just didn't really stick.
I do appreciate that the show often went there with kind of one-off stories.
Right.
But I would be forced to agree with you that that's not one of the better ones.
Speaking of that, Bob, let's talk about one of these villains that we do meet.
Yeah, Matt, were you happy for Magpie? Did you pop when Magpie showed up? I popped when Magpie showed up.
Oh my God, Bob, that's another one of those C-list characters that they could totally play with.
They have a list of characters that they can use, and it includes Mirror Man and Magpie, and it may include Killer Croc's mother, Matt.
It may
include Killer Croc's mother.
So, Bob, your first introduction to Magpie, and I'm mine as well, and I assume everybody in the world was Man of Steel number 3, correct? That's the first time the character's introduced.
It was my first exposure to her, but was that her first appearance or was it Batman 401? I wasn't sure which came first.
I think it was Man of Steel number 3 from what I read, but then again.
Because I didn't read Batman 401 as a kid because I think it was a little too pricey, but I do remember her on the cover. It was a pretty striking cover.
I do remember that cover as well. Magpie doesn't really last long in this show.
She immediately gets killed, which is very sad to me.
I didn't even get to learn why she was put there to begin with. Come on.
Well, you know why.
That's the joke. A magpie is someone that steals many things, folks, in case you're wondering. That's a thief.
If folks really want to read the good magpie stuff, the good magpie stuff is Arkham Asylum Living Hell. A lot of good use of her, good use of a lot of other C-list Batman villains. Sad we don't get any of that, but they need to kill her for dramatic effect. They also need to kill, for dramatic effect, the tall, suicidal Harley Quinn, I guess is how I'm going to have to describe this character.
What was up with her, Bob? I thought she was supposed to be someone important at first, and then it was turned out to be nothing. Just kind of a person who...
Well, I mean, she's like important for transformation, but no. It seemed she was going to be somebody, but I do sometimes like when these shows don't just recycle an old character and they do create something sort of new. Well, Matt, so I do have to say, and this is the big climax of this episode, spoilers, is basically Sophia kills all the Falcones in their mansion, right? And I just do have to say, to quote a friend's grandfather, there is something about a woman who might kill you in your sleep, Matt.
Yeah, they're a bit crazy, Bob.
I think you're innocent, so let me say this in a less innocent way. There's something very sexy about a woman who...
I understand, Bob. They're a bit wild, too. So, are we still as high on Sophia after this episode, Bob?
I don't know. I like the performance. I think the character's pretty good. I'm not really sure where this is all going or how effective it's going to be when it gets there. And I don't know. This sounds strange to complain about in a miniseries called The Penguin, but it did feel a little comic book origin to me. Does that make sense?
It really did. And I feel like I wish I would have gotten breadcrumbs with Sophia and said I got like the whole loaf with this episode. I got everything. I like her overall.
It's like, not the loaf. It's too big.
Exactly. Don't give me the whole loaf, guys. Just some crumbs. But I do like her overall arc. I would have liked it in smaller bits along the way, piecing it together myself, as opposed to having this whole flashback. Yeah.
I agree with you, although I don't want to say only 8 episodes because that's not a small amount, but if you assume we have episode 5 is also a Penguin flashback, then we just have 3 episodes to wrap this whole thing up.
That's a good point. And this really only is supposed to take place. I was reading some feedback and stuff about the show, and they said that, you know, this really is only supposed to take a couple of weeks after the Batman. So really, I think this only encompasses maybe the month or two after what happens in the Batman. And then maybe Matt Reeves' film will pick up in 2025.
Interesting. So he's not going to do the Batman Returns, Batman Forever, Batman and Robin thing of each film is nebulously probably a couple of years after the prior one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. What do you prefer when they do that kind of thing? Because they kind of do that with Nolan's stuff after the after the death of Heath Ledger. I feel like those were going to be closer than they were, but then they just let the time lapse go because of Heath Ledger's death.
I don't know if I have a strong opinion. I guess it depends on what they're trying to accomplish with the movie, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, Bob, in the ending of the episode, there's Sophia saves that little girl, basically, and she gasses the rest of the entire family. I have a feeling that little girl probably does have some significance somewhere down the line. That will come back to haunt either Sophia or something will go down there. I wonder if that child has some significance. Do you think so?
That little girl's name, Helena Bertinelli.
You think so?
Certainly possible, although
I didn't even catch the actual name.
Certainly it could be a good setup for a Huntress origin. I don't know if the Matt Reeves Batman universe is really going to be playing the long game like that.
I do like that. That final scene, though, was awesome with her walking through with the gas mask and the yellow dress. That made her seem more supervillainy.
Feeling very comic book supervillain origin.
Yes, yes. The whole ending there was just like a big superhero piece where she finally turned into this what she's become.
Let's go to episode 4 of Too Old to Die Young, The Tower. Matt, do you want to begin maybe by thanking the show for only having a 64-minute episode this week?
All right, Bob, don't hate me. All right.
Too late.
Yeah.
Too late.
But I've gotten really good at knowing which parts after watching enough of this and other reference stuff that I can skip ahead using that 10-second button. Mm-hmm. And I will literally notice no change on the screen. And I got it down. I got it down to 28 minutes, Bob. And the plot is completely intact.
I'm speechless. I know blankly and appallingly at my monitor with my mouth agape. I know that doesn't make for good podcasting, but that's what I'm doing.
I'm thinking of doing a fan edit at the end of all this, Bob, and putting it on YouTube, and it's going to only be an hour long, but it's going to be the whole show, the whole series. It's going to be awesome.
You Philistine. You Philistine.
I'll be honest with you. I only did that twice. Two scenes. Does that make you feel better?
Still appalling, but compared to the war crime, you were just...
I will tell you what the two scenes were. The first scene was the scene where he's crawling to her at the very beginning.
Because Matt was uncomfortable. Matt thought it was super.
My wife was walking in the room. It's just some chick sitting on a bed and some guy walking around. It's weird. The whole point of that scene was to show that she still had some dominance. She had dominance over him to some degree.
Yeah, I can't let my wife know that this is possible.
No. That's what it is, Bob. I understood it. I got the message. I got the point. So I fast forwarded 5 minutes and got the next scene. So we're good. It wasn't really 5 minutes, folks, but yeah, that was one scene. And then the other scene we'll talk about later on down the road.
Matt, speaking of somebody who's actually watching something, Martin's first victim, he's watching a movie, and I didn't really clock this when I watched this back in 2019, but I looked up the movie, and it's a 1961 movie starring Dennis Hopper. It's called Night Tide. And it was a low-budget movie that Rethin recently sponsored the restoration of. And it's a really cool movie. I watched it on YouTube last night. Dennis Hopper is a sailor. He's trying to pick up this woman, and it turns out that she's a mermaid and she may kill him.
Oh, okay.
It has themes in common with Too Old to Die Young. I believe the director was gay, and there's some really heavy-handed gay overtones to the film, too. My favorite is when two old men are talking in the sauna in this 1961 film in black and white. And one of them's like, oh, don't worry, I'll pound you later.
Oh, wow. And
he's massaging the guy and pounding him while he's saying that. So it gives enough plausible deniability. But we all watching, we know what's being said.
Yeah, any chance Refn will be like restoring 1992's Super Mario Brothers starring Dennis Hopper as King Koopa?
I want to say no, but I think given the influence of Neon and Synthesizer on the Nicholas Winding Refn style, we can't rule it out.
All right. I'd be down for that, Bob.
Actually, Matt, that does bring up a side tangent. You didn't go see Megalopolis in theaters because you're morally weak, right?
That's correct, Bob. And I usually just wait for things to come to streaming like a week later.
Well, in Megalopolis's case, that probably will happen. Megalopolis was a terrible movie. It's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. And yet it was really enjoyable, really engaging, really interesting. I think I gave it 3 stars on Letterboxd.
Okay.
Yeah, speaking of scenes that will make you uncomfortable to watch in front of your wife, there's an incest-themed scene with Aubrey Plaza. It's quite something.
Interesting.
Really, I would say Aubrey Plaza carries that movie on her back. She is the main thing in that movie as far as I'm concerned. She's great.
Oh, Aubrey Plaza is awesome. Great actress. Yeah, I love her in everything she's been in, honestly. I can't even think she hasn't been in.
Yeah, I stopped watching Agatha because she's not in it enough.
Exactly. Yeah. She was awesome that first episode, then bam, gone.
Yep, gone. But I did want to say, I think you should watch Megalopolis because A, it is terrible, and that's interesting. And B, it really has the vibe of an early 90s Tim Burton Batman or Warren Beatty Dick Tracy or Alex Baldwin The Shadow movie. Again, you're going to hate it. I mean, how could you not? But I think you would find it really interesting in hating it.
I'm actually down for that. That sounds awesome because that whole world from that early 90s, I don't know what it is, the Dick Tracy thematic thing. Oh, I love that. There's something about it.
90s doing the 30s. Back to Too Old to Die Young, Matt. So we got a great death scene where Viggo stabs this creep Greg in the throat, and we get a nice blood spray, arterial blood spray, onto the passenger window of the car. Do you think that was a squib or CGI?
All right, Bob, first off, let everyone know what a squib is.
I don't have a good technical definition, but it's basically when you have a packet that explodes to project fake blood effect.
It's an exploding blood bag, yes. I'm pretty sure it was a squib. Yes, it was a squib. I don't see CG. I went back and rewatched it because after I saw this question, I was like, yeah, definitely a squib. And the only reason Bob is even mentioning it is because it'll throw you off when you see it. If you watch this show, that scene will be like when he goes to stab the dude and it blows. You're like, whoa, something really cool just happened there. I don't even know how to describe it, but visually it's appealing.
It's really well done.
It's definitely a squib.
And arguably, this show is a little preachy, a little heavy-handed. We'll get into a little bit more of that later.
Uh-huh.
But, and by later, I mean right in a minute. But I do love whenever a cop show starts talking about the collapse of the U.S. empire. And we do have Viggo waxing poetic to Martin, John Hawks waxing poetic to Martin about it. So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that. But the real issue, Matt, is that we finally find out that Matt's favorite character, the character that Matt identified, we find out what he's about as the lieutenant leads the entire L.A. County Sheriff's Homicide Squad in chanting fascism and spelling out fascism. And then he plays a little ditty on the ukulele about fascism, police brutality. So, Matt, did you still feel like you were identifying with the lieutenant and his leadership style during this great scene?
No, Bob, but I am one of those people who has to sit there and submit to all that fascism and sit there and sing the chant with them. So I've been there. I know what it feels like.
Are you saying that in the Beep County state school system, that there's a lot of fascism in that?
Bob, I am not going to comment.
Matt, why can't you make a comment about the Beep County state school system and fascism?
Although, you know, playing a ukulele, Bob, is pretty cool.
The 2000s are calling, Matt. They want you to come back. They say you belong there. They say you are comfortable there.
Man, when he whips out that song, when he whips out that song by his mother too, Bob, that's the good part as well.
Oh yeah,
the mother, the song, which includes just saying Jesus and Mary, I believe, were the only two lyrics, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the lieutenant's a really versatile man, but lyrics are not as strong.
No, suit, obviously.
Yeah, no, my boy Noah and I were so excited about you getting to this scene.
I was miserable. I was just glad he didn't end up being the one. I was so scared watching the beginning of the episode, thinking he was going to end up being like one of the child molesters or something that they stabbed. But I don't know what's worse. Yeah. But I don't know what's worse at this point.
Fascist or not, mate, have your choice.
Yeah, I will say that I'm more like he was in the last episode, not this episode. But I do know where know where he's coming from with the fascism and the ukulele.
The ukulele fascism. It's coming, folks. It's the new thing. So I did want to say, speaking of musical instruments, so that song we always hear at the ice rink, you know, before Damien shows up, it's apparently played by a famous Jamaican saxophonist named Roland Alfonso. So I just wanted to highlight that. Speaking of grim things, were you surprised that Martin wasn't willing to go through killing this Korean guy for Damien?
A little bit, Bob. And this is what I need you to help me here with this. Am I supposed to understand that he has no morality and he's looking for something to do or to believe in? Or is it that he suddenly has this moral compass and wants to be like Dexter and justify his killings?
I think it's more the latter.
Okay.
I think it's more, he seems like a guy who, what, he wouldn't necessarily have always been a serial killer. but he seems like so blank that when the chance to become a serial killer and as a cop presented itself, he just went with it. Now that he kind of went with it, he's like, oh, maybe there's a way I can, you know, do this better Dexter style.
Bob, would you kill a dude for $8,000?
So help me remember, is $8,000 what the Korean guy owes?
Yes, that's how much he owes.
Okay, and it's not clear how much Martin is going to make off of it. But
correct, yes.
I will say $8,000 seems like a relatively small debt to have somebody murdered.
I agree, Bob. I was like, $8,000. I mean, you could like go online and probably find someone with a credit score that could get you a $10,000 loan if you needed that. You could get a $10,000 loan somehow. You could find a way signing over your name or something. If
$8,000 is about how much I owe my credit card. I make regular payments on it.
But if they come after you, I mean, they're just going to write it off. They're not going to come kill you if you don't pay it. I still understand why that would be. You can get that kind of money somehow to pay back without needing to chop your finger off. I was very surprised.
Yeah.
But then again, when this came out in 2019, right? So that's the
2019. It was before Joeflation, but as bad as Joeflation has been, it wasn't that bad.
And I mean, I don't know. Maybe the Korean guy, he doesn't have a great credit score. I don't know.
Damien doesn't strike me as a man who checks credit. All respect to Damien. He's one of my favorite gangsters, but I don't think he checks credit scores, and I do have to a little bit question his judgment on having. Presumably, he has to pay Martin at least $5,000, right?
Right.
He thinks that's about right.
So he's getting like, I mean, he's going to get $3,000 back from his debt. I mean,
No, because the guy's dead. He's not. All he's getting is the intimidation factor of, oh, I killed this guy for $8,000. And it actually cost him. I guess maybe he's not paying Martin because he's telling Martin, you owe me. But if we value that at $5,000, he's expending $5,000 worth of Martin's service.
Just to kill somebody that owed him $8,000.
My trauma is to Matt. I'm making him watch this show. Matt, what did you think of the befingering in the show?
All right, Bob. This is the other area where I skipped the befingering piece. I watched it up to the point where he went to the... I said, I have seen someone be befingered more times in my life, Bob, on film, video games. I think I've even had to like push the button to do it on video games. I'm to the point I don't want to see it anymore. Oh. That whole befingering scene, Bob, was my shot of the episode because of the red hue they used. That was really well put
Matt
together.
Loves a red hue.
I do. Put a red hue, make it look like the red room from Twin Peaks, you're good. And I don't really know what was going on there. I don't know if that was meant to be like a family situation and they're just hanging out. I don't know what that was, but it was creepy.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, I like a red hue. For me, I would say the shot of the episode is just this whole spectacle of how weird the detectives are being when they're chanting fascism and cheering the lieutenant. It's very strange. It's very haunting. I like that a lot.
It's so
and
damn
Matt, I think you had a request from your friend Bob. I think you had a request for dare I say, a trigger warning from your friend Bob.
Yeah, Bob. I just want to remind you that when we do have these shows, especially with this next episode, which I went ahead and I stopped before it started, but I noticed that it had like a bunch of, and then I also noticed the very first scene was a casting couch with a gay man. I'm going to need a disclaimer, Bob, before I watch these, just in case if wife's in the room, I need to be like, oh, you probably need to watch these alone, just because, you never know. These are kind of freaky.
Well, Matt, I would generally reply to that in the same way I reply to my students when they request content warnings, which is to say, I teach a lot of things. I'm a very desensitized person. You can't expect me to remember everything in everything I teach that might specifically bother you. So sensitive. It's up to you to use the web to find out. And then if you think something might be a problem, we could talk about whether you're going to watch it. That's what I tell my students. And that's what I would generally tell you, Matt, but you've already divined this. I would say even I, a person who's a very degraded, desensitized, callous person, even I remember the next episode of this show is really messed up. So yeah, definitely don't watch it with your wife.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Yeah, and heads up to the listeners as well. Just fair warning. Bob, character of the week goes to Janie, and it's for breaking that stereotype I'd just automatically placed on her. She's apparently book smart because she got into all these schools, and she's dominant over Martin, which is the opposite of what we thought. And Martin's apparently very stupid because he thinks stabbed is an adjective. So learned a little bit about him too.
He is a very dumb guy.
Yeah.
He is a very dumb guy.
Not the brightest.
All right. I'm going to give it to Diana, who we didn't talk about much this episode, but she has a good episode. And she is starting to remind me a little bit of the High Priestess of Death when she's handing out targets to Vigo or when she's sitting with him in all black while he's doing chemo. So, yeah, good episode for Diana.
Sometimes, Bob, I'm kind of wondering, though, is she just making that stuff up just to kill people?
Could be. Okay. Get that vibe from her.
Because that's the whole reason that, you know, Vigo teaches Martin that it's easier to murder when you have that reason. And she's given him that reason. But she just comes up with that out of nowhere. You don't really see her doing any research or anything. At the same time, dude, I don't think the dude's not doing chemo, though. He's doing what I might have to do one day, Bob, which is a kidney thing, dialysis.
All right. Thanks for listening to Uncanny Treks. I'm Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland. Have a great night, everyone.
Thanks for listening.